Now, our first guest today on our animal programme has been on the show before, and he's back today to talk about his latest book, Cull of the Wild, Killing in the Name of Conservation. Delighted to welcome back to the show, Hugh Warwick.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm glad I didn't disgrace myself the first time round.
You didn't, because we've had you back, so that's a good thing. Now, this wasn't an easy one for me. When the producer gave it to me, I'm like, killing animals, not sure. But I know it wasn't an easy one for you either, because you're a conservationist who loathes the idea of killing or harming animals. But yet, as an ecologist, you know it's sometimes necessary. So we need to learn that too. Can you explain?
Well, I suppose, okay, first of all, this book, Cull of the Wild, Killing in the Name of Conservation, was the first draft of it began with the word prejudice. That word slipped a bit down the text now, but it was the first word, because what I wanted to do right at the beginning was to explain that I recognize I come to this story with my own prejudice, my own baggage. Mm. We all have it. And it's one of the essences of being a scientist by training is that you're taught that you don't know stuff. That's the whole point of science, is that you're always testing what you think might be right and trying to see whether it is right or whether it is wrong. So I've got my prejudice. I know I'm right, okay? Of course I do, because everyone around me on social media tells me I'm right. In fact, most of them tell me I'm quite half-hearted in what I get up to. So we all have our own prejudices. Mine are quite simple. As you say, I'm an animal lover. I'm a bunny hugger. I've not eaten meat for nearly 40 years. I was 10 years a strict vegan, but then, well, I've become what I describe as a vegan, vaguely vegan, because I discovered that my willpower was not as strong as the cakes of the Women's Institute were good. I know where I am on this thing. But also, my work as an ecologist means that I'm confronted by things where animals are harmed, animals are killed. And right at the start of my work, way back in 1986, I was looking at the impact of hedgehogs on ground nesting birds up in Orkney. And in the end, that resulted in these animals. The hedgehogs had been imported to the island by the postman back in the 1970s, and they were causing trouble. So they did an airlift. They shifted the hedgehogs off the island. Then in the noughties, in 2003, conservationists started killing hedgehogs in the Outer Hebrides. I went up there to look at the story, obviously, because fascinating, and found out that the reason they were justifying killing was wrong, and I did the research which stopped the killing taking place. At the same time, New Zealand started killing hedgehogs. Our hedgehogs. We exported hedgehogs to New Zealand in the 1860s because we were, to put it bluntly, stupid. And we sent them over there because people wanted to feel more like they were at home. The hedgehogs are causing a conservation impact on New Zealand. I cannot see a reason not to kill the hedgehogs in New Zealand. And so there we have the beginning of the book, was this conflict between my love of hedgehogs, but also the realization that in some situations I can't see a way out of it.
Can you give us an example then of a situation that you can't see the way out of?
Okay, so in the UK, we've got one of the cutest mammals, other than hedgehogs, are water voles. Water voles are utterly gorgeous. They're tied deeply into our folklore and our stories. Wind in the Willows features a ratty who is a water vole. People love water voles. When they see a water vole, they know it and they love it. Water voles are the fastest declining mammal in the UK. And you can do all of the work you need to make their habitat along the edges of rivers and streams beautiful for water voles. But if the American mink, which escaped from fur farms, are still there, then the water voles will simply be eaten. And so if we want to have beautiful water voles, we need them not to be mink. And for them to not be mink, we need people to kill the mink. And so this is a choice. It's like, well, do we have enough willpower to kill the mink if we want to have the water voles? How much is our desire to have water voles? How much is there of a desire to have an ecosystem which is something like what it used to be? And that's one of the big questions we have to ask ourselves. For example, in London now, in fact, all over the country, these amazing, beautiful birds, the ringneck parakeets, are they are a menace in some respects. They interfere with the capacity for woodpeckers and nuthatches to breed because they steal their nesting holes. Yet there isn't the will to kill the parakeets, but there is the will to kill the mink. I mean, it's all down to what the social desire is as well. It's not just down to what the ecologists think.
But aren't we sort of playing God? Is it our right to decide on that?
Oh, I mean, Celine, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is an issue about playing God. But you've got to think about this. I'm often confronted with this. Should we just let nature take its course is the response. And yes, we should let nature take its course if we hadn't already upset it. We've already played God by introducing mink to the countryside, by introducing grey squirrels to this place, by introducing rats to islands in the South Atlantic. In those instances, we've already done the playing God. Mm-hmm. Now, we can say, okay, let's leave nature to take its course. But what we are doing then is dumping on the shoulders of the natural world even more work to do. I mean, they're already, the natural world, nature, is already having to deal with, you know, pollution in our rivers from the chicken farms and from sewage, dealing with climate change, dealing with ocean acidification, dealing with the loss of forests. Nature's got a lot on its plate already. And so we can say, okay, fine, let's abrogate ourselves from this responsibility. Let's toss our hands up into the air and say, oh, let's leave nature to take its course. That is I would suggest a cowardly way out. It's not confronting the reality that we've already played God. We've already messed it up. Are we going to be grown up enough to tidy up the mess we've made? Well, there's the question.
So who decides? You said it's whether we've got the will or not. So you're saying that we've got the will to kill the mink in order to keep the voles. But aren't the mink just beautiful animals as well?
Of course, mink are stunningly beautiful animals. In fact, I wrote this book. This is going to sound very weird. I wrote this book with a mink coat hanging from the bookshelf next to me.
No.
After my mother had died and I was clearing out the house, I found her old mink coat in the back of the wardrobe. And I was at that moment, what do I do with it? I remember it as a child. I remember her leaning over to kiss me goodnight before she went out for dinner wearing that coat, and I can still smell the perfume in my mind. No, you're absolutely right. Mink are stunningly beautiful animals. They're in the wrong place at the wrong time. So in terms of the social will, though, you look at these things. You can say, yes, we should do X. We should remove the mink. There isn't a vocal opposition to doing that. There are some with very valid reasons about, as you say, not wanting to play God. But there isn't a massive opposition to it. I would argue that there should be a massive opposition to trying to kill all of the grey squirrels in United Kingdom, for example. Mm. Because, I mean, grey squirrels, again, another amazing, gorgeous creature. It's unfortunate. You know, their income is from America as well. And they carry with them a virus. It's called squirrel pox virus. And this kills red squirrels, our native squirrel. So that's the reason you can't, if you want to have your native red squirrels, you can't have grey squirrels. But you can't have an ongoing process of controlling grey squirrels forever. All you're doing then is harvesting squirrels. Yeah, the problem is never solved. However, I met a fascinating conservationist on the island of Anglesey off the North Wales coast called Craig Shuttleworth, and he had killed around 7,000 grey squirrels by hand with a small wooden truncheon after trapping them. And he had killed all of these, removing all the grey squirrels from this island so that the red squirrels could thrive. So, for example, yes, I mean, there was social will for an eradication on a small scale on an island. There wouldn't be social will for continually killing squirrels forever in the mainland of the United Kingdom. We've got to choose our battles wisely.
And the way, I mean, I'm sure that was a very ethical way, the way you've just described it happened, but presumably that's the next question. It has to be done quickly and with as less pain as possible to the animal.
Oh, completely. And this is, I actually asked Craig as we were walking around, I asked him whether he was a psychopath. Did he enjoy killing? I didn't put it quite like that. Uh-huh. Yeah, did he enjoy doing this? And at no point did he enjoy doing it.
No.
But he knew the only way to enable red squirrels to thrive on the island was to remove the grey squirrels. I'm very suspicious of people who get a kick out of killing. You know, I think that's pretty weird. You know, I can understand I've had to kill injured animals in the past. Yeah, I hate it. As I say, I've not eaten meat for nearly 40 years. I don't want to be involved with the killing of animals. I do get suspicious of people who are really, really excited about killing animals. But no, I mean, but there are millions of people around the world who do get a kick out of it. Mm-hmm. I think it morally, I think it's wrong. I think if animals are to be killed, it should be done with respect and with sadness. But that's my personal opinion.
Could you do it, Hugh, if you were wandering around with this conservationist who was doing this to the squirrels because he you know, he didn't enjoy it, he was doing it for the right reason, but he said, look, there's so many, I need your help. Could you do it?
Oh, you are horrible.
I know, well, I've got to ask these questions.
I think it would need to be very much a case that he couldn't do it and I would step in to do it. But I wouldn't do it just for fun, as it were. A good friend of mine who has lately become a vegan did a program for Channel 4 about veganism. And in that, he went and shot a deer on a deer stalking trip and shed a tear as he did it. The reason he was doing that was because you can't have rewilding. You can't have forests flourishing in far-off places if there are as many deer as there are, especially in Scotland, actually all over the United Kingdom. We've got way too many deer because we don't have the predators to keep their numbers down. So humanity has to step in and be a predator.
Oh, so sad though, isn't it?
Yeah, he did that as a show, you know, for the show, and you know, was remorseful about it, and then actually ate some of the deer he shot because you know, no point letting it go to waste. I don't think I could go quite that far. I mean, you know, that was to some extent performative, but it made a very good point. There are people who are able to do this sort of thing. And we all have our different skill sets. There are people I know who are as terrified at the idea of sitting in front of a computer and writing a book as I would be of going off and killing an animal. You know, we all have things we can do. And so rather than having it as something which is, you know, a free-for-all for other people to take part in, I think it has to be professionals treating these animals with enormous respect.
Yes, quite frankly, I'm suspicious of any human being that doesn't like animals because I think you're just weird.
Absolutely, yes.
Now, I've got a couple more questions to ask you. We've just watched Narcos about Pablo Escobar. There's a connection, isn't there, with the cocaine hippos and the Burmese python pet trade?
Oh, my goodness me. I had so much fun. I mean, so in writing Cull of the Wild, I was restricted partly initially by the leftovers from COVID, but also money and time. So I couldn't really go off and visit lots of exotic places. I'd have loved to have gone to Hawaii and the Galapagos and to New Zealand and to Australia. But yeah, the budget wasn't there. I mean, if anybody wants to drop me a few quid, that'd be great. But as I was looking around these stories, yes, the Pablo Escobar cocaine hippos, it was one of those stories, I think this has got to be made up. But anyway, the cocaine baron, he'd collected a bunch of animals for a wildlife park. And after he was killed by the security services, his animals kind of just escaped and let loose. And hippos made themselves at home. And they to begin with, this was like it was a novelty. But then the hippos started breeding, and then it became rather challenging because hippos are quite big, quite dangerous creatures, and they've started affecting the ecosystem in their homeland. And so they have been looking at trying to control the hippos, but also it's very difficult to do that. So the hippos at the moment are being fairly much left alone. But in Florida, they've got these pythons, these amazing pythons, which escape from pet stores and all sorts of things. And again, they have an impact on the ability of the natural ecosystem to flourish. Now, there are so many other threats in these places too, and the pythons are just a final bit to it. There are all sorts of ways of trying to control the pythons, which just seem to be pretty horrible. There are competitions, you know, who can kill the most pythons in a weekend or whatever. But it's, again, those things aren't being done. I should say, the stories which I covered in depth are ecologists who are treating it really respectfully And they're going into places very carefully and working out the ways of doing it with the minimum amount of harm to not just to the species they're trying to control. I say harm, they will kill them, but not to cause them to suffer, but also to try and to minimize any external damage as well.
Mm. What about one of our oldest living creatures, the tortoise? Are they harm to anyone?
Well, it is interesting you say that. Actually, some of the tortoises which have been moved around the world, because the fascination of finding these enormous Galapagos tortoises, I mean, they are an animal which will have an impact on the ecosystem into which they're brought. But, I mean, one of the good things about a tortoise is that their rate of reproduction is quite slow. Another good thing about the tortoise is if you're really wanting to catch up with it, it's quite easy to do it. I mean, the problem is when you've got animals which are fast and fast breeding. For example, up in Orkney, in 2011, they first noticed stoats on the island. These little mustelids, amazing, beautiful animals. They've never been up in Orkney before, and they were seen for the first time in 2011. And the reason the stoats are so scary and dangerous from a conservation point of view is that stoats are always pregnant. Female stoats are always pregnant. When a female gives birth, a male will find her and will mate with her straight away, and he will then mate with the female kits, the female young, however small they are. Now, they're too small to have a pregnancy. They have a thing called delayed implantation. So when those baby female stoats have matured enough to get out into the wild, they're already pregnant. And so this just means you've got the ability of the stoats to spread is staggering. And I mean, this is, I look on to the stoat in admiration. I mean, they've got this amazing ability. It's just that on Orkney, you've got most of the birds nesting on the ground. And you've also got there's the Orkney vole. It's only found in Orkney. The Orkney vole will be driven to extinction if the stoats aren't controlled. And the bird numbers will drop enormously too.
It's a bit like a pack of cards, isn't it? I don't know, it just goes on and on. I mean, each species is important for another species or can kill another species, and it's just a vicious circle.
I think which is also important is to realize we're never going to be able to turn this into some sort of prelapsarian idyll. It's never going to be back to something good. We've done so much alteration to the natural world already. What we need to do is look at seeing how we can have the best result. We can't make it perfect. And one of the things which I remember, I can't remember who told me this, it would have probably been a teacher at some point, and it was the warning about letting the perfect get in the way of the good. And there may be, there are people who will be wanting to make this absolutely perfect. We need to remove everything. We need to return this to, I don't know, a time before, I don't know what, the Romans? I don't know, the Normans? Where are we going to draw a line? But also, the point is, if you spend it trying to achieve perfection, you'll miss out on just making it good.
Indeed. Well, it's fascinating stuff. It really is. And people can find out much more from your book, which people can pre-order from our website right now. It's called Cull of the Wild, Killing in the Name of Conservation. I believe it's out on the 28th of March. And it's by Hugh Warwick, who we're chatting to now. Hugh, I know you've written lots of other books and there's lots about you and hedgehogs and everything else. So what's your website address?
HughWarwick.com. I should say, can I say, about 15 minutes before I came online to talk to you, I had sent send on my next book off to the publisher. It's been quite a day, and I've got another book to finish before the end of April. So there's a lot going on. So yeah, I have written a lot about hedgehogs, but I do write about other things too. The next book coming is about bats. I've written about beavers and water voles and all sorts of things. I'm at Hedgehog Hugh. It's probably the easiest way of tracking me down on social media, Twitter and Instagram, at Hedgehog Hugh. I started studying hedgehogs probably because it was a simple alliteration, but that's made it difficult. Now I'm writing about other things. But anyway, at Hedgehog Hugh, you'll find me and all the sorts of things I get up to.
Wonderful. I think the last book we chatted to you about was Beauty and the Beast.
Oh, now that was fun. Oh, I loved doing that. Oh, so the thing about the Beauty and the Beast, I went and met 15 people a bit like me, people who had got passions for other species. I had to make out to my wife how hard I worked to make that book happen. But the reality was I'd have done it again and again, because meeting people who care about nature, who care about species and are willing to share that love with you is just one of the greatest rewards for this work.
I am with you 100% on that. Thank you so much, Hugh, for joining us on today's show. And we'll hopefully be in touch again and talk to you about bats next time.
Thanks, Selena.
Thanks, Hugh. Bye-bye.